Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Hello. Hello, hello. Nice to be here. Listen, on the show today, Bri Webb, my old friend Bri Webb, is going to be on the program to discuss his forthcoming release, Free Will, and he's playing at Kazoo Fest this week, opening up for Destroyer. We'll probably talk about punk rock. We'll probably talk about family life, being in Guelph. We don't know what we're going to talk about. It's going to be fun. So that's coming up, and you're going to hear brand new music from Bri's new record. That's really all I have to say. So let's just get the show started, shall we? Okay, we shall.
Kazoo Fest is back again from April 9th to 13th with great bands like
Destroyer,
Legato Vipers,
Diana,
Bri Webb,
Cousins,
Jesse Bell Smith,
Hooded Fang,
The Furies,
Petroglint,
Noah 23,
Soup Cans,
Bird City,
Nihilus Spasm Band,
Vic NS,
Vag Halen,
Michael Furistack,
and Jeff Barbara.
Plus, Kazoo Print Expo,
art installations,
film screenings,
and a pancake breakfast.
For schedule, ticket details, and venue accessibility information, visit kazookazoo.ca.
Bri Webb is one of Canada's most distinctive singers, songwriters, and musicians. Based in Guelph, Webb emerged from London, Ontario's post-hardcore punk scene, fronting an excellent band called Shoulder. In the late 1990s, he co-founded a Guelph-based band called Constantines, who had a profound impact on rock music during their 10-year run. In 2011, Webb released Provider, his first solo album, and he did his best to tour the world behind it as a new father with a day job. On May 20th, the Toronto label Idéfix will release Webb's new album. It's called Free Will, and he'll be touring behind it a lot this spring and summer, including a hometown show opening for Destroyer at Kazoo Fest on Friday, April 11th. Here now to discuss this further is Bri Webb. Hi, Bri.
Hi, Vish.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm pretty well. It's nice to be here. Now, just so people realize this, we're actually in CFRU's HQ, as it were, which is not always the case for this show.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm just pulling the wool over under, out from, away from people's eyes.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I'm here and sometimes I do my show elsewhere because that's just the way I do it. But it's good to be here. Now you work here.
I do.
And what's that like?
It's lovely.
Yeah.
It's a nice community hub. I started this job about it'll be 4 years ago in August. And I had just relocated to Guelph, and I don't know, I was taking a break from playing music, trying to figure some stuff out, and I think by virtue of getting this job, I ended up connecting far more quickly with a lot of people in this community doing, you know, disparate, interesting things. And it's been, you know, it's continued that way. It's just kind of grown into really connecting with a lot of amazing stuff in town.
Yeah.
It's a nice place.
Now, since I've known you, I feel like that sense of community is really important to you, right? I mean, you like... In London, did you have something similar in London? Did you feel like there was like a community that supported you and that you wanted to be a part of?
Yeah, in the early 90s in London, Ontario, there was a really great community of showgoers. You know, there was a neat convergence of a punk rock scene and kind of an indie rock, or those kind of what were disparate at the time kind of came together, and everybody was just going to each other's shows, and there were basement shows, but there were also club shows. And London also has a great all ages space, all ages club called Call the Office, which, you know, I think was instrumental in how I grew up seeing music and being exposed to music. So, you know, it was great. And I ended up having a really similar situation to what I have here now, and that I worked at CHRW in London.
That's like the campus station there?
Yeah, as the music director for a few years before leaving London and starting the Constantines.
Right. Okay, so community radio, I mean, it's right in the name, community radio. There's something about you and community. Mm-hmm. It's always been important.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's just I'm a pretty shy person, and I've always had a bit of trouble imagining how to relate to the world on a scale that's larger than one's own community. So I just feel like I can connect more with people within my immediate surroundings, you know, and I like to see activism and art engage on that level. I feel like that's sort of where it's most vital.
It's funny that I know a lot of people are often surprised when they hear tell that you might be a shy guy, because you know, in terms of having a public persona, for as long as I've known you, you've been yelling into microphones and screaming. Mm-hmm. It's a very extroverted presence that you have, you know, back from. So, like, just so, and I don't know if this is valuable information, but we've known each other a long time, mm-hmm. and we both came out of this Southern Ontario post-hardcore scene. So that was an interesting... I sometimes wonder about that period as what kind of incubator that really was, mm-hmm. on us psychologically, mm-hmm. because we just... A lot of us were kind of shy, but had something within us that we wanted to present. And for some reason, punk rock really enabled it. Mm-hmm. And so, like, can you kind of envision yourself before and after you engaged with punk rock as an active participant? And I don't mean just as a listener, maybe. Because I don't know. Actually, let's talk about... I want to talk about everything.
Well, I think I know what you're talking about, or I can relate to what you're talking about, in that, like, I think if you think about the usual mechanisms or channels of the music industry and trying to, I don't know, a band like musicians starting to make music and then wanting to find an audience or be discovered or something, although I don't know how that, if that stuff even works that way anymore, but those sort of that idea of something was totally just not, didn't seem within the realm of possibility or anything that I was even comfortable pursuing. But with punk rock, like, I mean, I was a skateboarder and I connected with music through that, kind of, you know, I loved music and I discovered a lot of early stuff, formative stuff like Bad Brains and the Sex Pistols and Black Flag and stuff like that through skateboarding. And then because that music was kind of, you know, not, didn't demand like a technical skill to get started in. You could play kind of loose and only know a few chords and learn and get together with friends and work out songs with those limited materials. Mm. That was really inviting. And then the idea of, you know, realizing that people were doing shows in London, Ontario at community centers and basement shows and things like that, that weren't, you didn't have to send a demo tape to a promoter, or, you know, try and get through the usual channels of like publicizing yourself. It was just you skateboarded with some folks who were also doing a show, and then they just asked if you wanted to play the show. So that, I don't know if I would have pursued music at all if it hadn't have been that inviting, if I hadn't had that inviting a context for.
But also empowering.
Yeah, for sure.
Like you could just, it's funny having watched it all evolve. And, you know, even us, by the time, you know, in the mid-90s, the concept of DIY or punk rock had been around a long time. Mm-hmm. And now it's, I feel like it's across the board in mainstream culture. Like there's, I've talked about this many times, but there's like all these shows where you're like, here's how you cook things. Here's how you make stuff yourself. Here's how you build a deck, you know? Mm-hmm. And like everyone's just constantly like, I can do everything myself.
Mm-hmm. And it's sort of the amount of information, like it's a free access to information phenomenon too, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah, and maybe the internet is punk rock, or it used to be.
Well, I think it connects to that. Like, it just is.
Community and...
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's... Has it happened so gradually that we don't... Because I ascribe politics to punk rock and some kind of, I don't know, harder edge to it. But as I see it infiltrating mainstream culture, it seems softer. Like, I mean, like when I say a cooking, it doesn't seem like a political action, but in a way it is. You know, mm-hmm. you're saving money. You're doing things yourself. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I don't know. Just this idea of being enabled to do something by an external force, this seems to have happened with you.
Yeah. I recently was asked to write the liner notes for the new reissue of A Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet record, the Dim the Lights, Chill the Ham record, which was a very formative record for me, mm-hmm. You know, when I was 15 or something like that and starting to play music. And that was part of what I tried to address, and that was that it was discovering bands like Shadowy Men who were really engaged with that network of people doing their own shows in unconventional spaces that was empowering. It made it seem possible to be a band and, you know, do things ourselves, to book our own shows and like rent a school bus and go to a festival, you know, of other bands that were playing at a community center in Brantford or something like that. You know, it was a window into something that I didn't know existed before that. I thought, you know, probably until I was 13 that all bands were rock stars, you know, and all mm-hmm. all bands were part of this massive, inaccessible system. You know?
Right, right. They were on a stage, we were down below.
Right.
You couldn't, yeah. So there was like a leveling of the playing field, so to speak.
Yeah.
I'm curious about your family life in terms of how that inspired or influenced your desire to play music. Because for me, when I look back on it, part of my interest in music... I sometimes think that part of my interest in music, or certainly underground music, resulted from kind of mistrust of mainstream culture. Mm-hmm. And I had a strange relationship with my parents who were really discouraging of my interest in music. And I'm just curious, and that fueled a lot of why I wanted to play and what I wanted to play. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a little anger in it. But what about you? Did you have a support network or?
I think the way I connect with what you're talking about is when I was first, you know, interested in playing, like in buying a guitar or something like that, my folks were very pragmatic, very practical, you know, and didn't really, I think buying a guitar or like playing music or something like that was something that was detached from practicality. You know, so I think that was a bit of, it was just a way of asserting my independence for sure. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, but they, you know, that said, they helped me find a, you know, $100 guitar in a pawn shop and you know, were encouraging. I think they just wanted to make sure that I was legitimately interested and not just, you know, that I was going to take responsibility for it if I was going to claim it as a thing.
Do those instincts, now that you and I are both dads now, and we're still, I mean, your son is three, mm-hmm. my son is almost three, so we're still new to this, but our parents make more sense to us now, in a sense? Like, I don't know if you had a thing where your parents didn't make sense to you. But on some level, their worry, their overbearing kind of concern, like I had the same thing. Like, think practically. Like, that's a thing that parents will instill upon in you, and you fight it a little bit because you're a kid and you don't know any better, maybe. But have you seen the light, so to speak, in terms of where they were coming from?
I think I understand the vulnerability of my parents, you know, and the fear that comes with being responsible for someone else, like, you know, being solely responsible for bringing someone into the world, and how that plays into those impulses, right? Like, I really want to direct Asa, my son, to have a fruitful life, but to be able to like sustain himself and to make responsible decisions. But I think a lot of the stuff, you know, any kind of inclination to encourage him to more practical decisions, even at this age, come from a fear of like his own safety or his own, like, of his vulnerability and my vulnerability as the person responsible for him.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And that's probably where your folks were coming from.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know?
But it doesn't feel that way, does it? Like, when you're a kid, it doesn't feel that way. You just feel like you're being oppressed, not guided.
Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about how all sorts of, you know, experiences, you know, varying stages, varying levels of trauma, you know, in everyone's life give you context for these things, you know, give you greater understanding, a greater like tolerance for other people or your interactions with them, you know. But at 3 or 10 or, you know, 15 even, I think you don't have a ton of context in that way, you know. So it's just, you know, why are these people telling me that this is right?
It seems to me that until you're responsible, well, this is horrible. I mean, I don't know if it's horrible, but when I think about it, maybe you don't see the preciousness of life until you're responsible for another.
I think that's there. I know why you maybe hesitate saying that.
It sounds like very heavy-handed, but like, you know, I, and you do it too, like in our lifestyle, sometimes I find myself driving home at 4 in the morning after being in Toronto or something, or being at a show or being on tour, and just like hurtling through space in this metal box in the middle of the night with depleted. And I used to never think twice about that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just doing a thing, and I'm a human being, and, you know, I have people who care for me and would worry for me, but I just do this. And now I'm like, should I be hurtling through space? Like, I have a real responsibility here. And it sort of for me anyway, having a kid, it recalibrates your system in terms of what is important.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I relate to that in that I think for part of my life, especially as a musician and when I was touring and, you know, committed more to that lifestyle, there was this, detachment from reality or something, or, you know, from a certain level of reality or a detachment from,
you feel a little
mortality.
Yeah, exactly. You feel a little immortal.
Yeah. I think certainly since Asa arrived, I've felt more aware of that from moment to moment than I was for years before anyway, you know?
I want to ask you about, because you mentioned buying a guitar or your parents helping you buy a $100 guitar. What drew you to that instrument? Who drew you to that instrument? Were there players that you were like, you were emulated? Because you have a very distinctive style. Like, a lot of people credit you for having a very distinctive and inventive approach to playing guitar, but I'm wondering where that comes from.
Well, I think, I don't know. I mean, it was the period that I really discovered or engaged with music as a, you know, as someone that realized that I had agency in my interest in that was pretty incredible in terms of what was available even in mainstream culture, like through the late 80s and early 90s. You know, I was, you know, into AC/DC and stuff like that, but, and that was really early kind of interest in the guitar, because that is definitely guitarist front and center in that group.
Which young brother were you most drawn to?
Angus
was, because
yeah. I developed an appreciation for Malcolm, certainly, but Angus, I mean, it was just a very, you know, especially as a kid, you see a grown man dressed in a schoolboy outfit playing an SG, and he's a really lyrical player.
Yeah.
You know, if you, you know, consider what, you know, he's playing, but so that was really early. But even from that, I remember, you know, listening to that and then hearing about The Cure and Jane's Addiction and stuff. And so around the time, like, AC/DC was in my consciousness, there was much music, and much music was quite different at the time as well, and was like, there was a show called City Limits that was on mm-hmm. Friday nights from midnight till like 3 a.m. or something. And so I remember videotaping City Limits and watching that, you know, on the weekend, and it would be like features on The Residents and The Cure and stuff like that. And so, you know, I for that to be available in commercial culture was amazing for a 13-year-old, you know.
Yeah.
And that stuff all kind of melded together. And around the same time, like, as I said, there was a lot of stuff that was associated with skateboarding, like the Bad Brains and Husker Du and Minor Threat and stuff like that. And Nirvana was, like, you know, exploding around that time. And I heard the Sex Pistols around that same time as well. So it was a lot of, like, you know, pretty eccentric ways of playing that were all available. You know?
Right. Okay. And so was I mentioned earlier that you were in a band called Shoulder. That's the first time I encountered you and your music. Was that your first band?
No, I was in a band, like, with the first proper group I ever played in was called SOS, which stood for Skeletons of Society.
Skeletons of Society?
Yeah. We were, we played, you know, exclusively in my friend Mark's basement, and we would take classic rock riffs, steal classic rock riffs like Sunshine of Your Love, and then just write, like, juvenile lyrics over top and consider them our own song, and then record them on, like, a tape deck, you know.
Huh. So you're interested in, you were, and your friends were interested in some form of documentation even then?
I guess. I mean, it was just available. Mm. You know, my father used to tape songs from the radio and make mixtapes for me as a kid. So
oh, nice.
I was aware of that technology of just being able to record things, and that stuff was always around. But so that was the first thing.
How old were you when SOS was?
I think we started it in grade 9.
Oh, like okay.
Early grade 9, so I was 14 or something
right.
like that.
Okay.
And then various skate punk outfits, you know, in London.
That's a pretty good
stuff.
That's a good age to kind of overcome that boundary of this music is beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, being able to play seems beyond me to, I'm just going to try playing. Because
mm-hmm.
I think for me and others, it probably took a bit longer.
Yeah. I don't know why. I do know why. At the time, the person who first told me that it was possible to, like, just get a guitar for cheap and try it was my grade 8 teacher, David Garrison, who was, you know, he was in, like, cover bands in London, and we wrote autobiographies in our grade 8 class, and I remember writing that I was interested in playing the guitar, and I took the cover, the actual cassette cover for Who Made Who by AC/DC, and put it in my like autobiography book that I was and he talked to me after I submitted that and just said, you know, you can get a guitar for $100, and he had an amp, like a beautiful Fender Super Reverb that he had at the university or at the elementary school
mm-hmm.
and he just would set it up in this room behind the gym and let me plug this guitar that I had gotten at a pawn shop in there, like during recess, and play a guitar.
Wow.
That's amazing. When I started. But that was just for someone to say, no, a guitar isn't like $1,000 or, you know, you can find something. And the first guitar I had was ridiculous. It was like a spiky red, like it looked like something out of a, like Judas Priest video.
Okay.
And the neck was like the size of a baseball bat. So right. that was a little discouraging at the time, but it was, yeah, just to be able to get a guitar and play was pretty exciting.
Yeah. Shoulder was interesting because, whenever we'd see it live, it was a really powerful rock kind of thing. And then when I got the record, how many albums did you just put out? The one album, Touch?
One CD and then a couple of 7-inches, yeah.
Yeah, right. And there's like some compilation stuff floating mm-hmm. around. But the record Touch was interesting because it has this, there's songs on it, of course, but then there's these interstitial kind of guitar things going on. That's you?
Yeah, Paul and I.
And you just, it's like acoustic guitar or
yeah.
something.
I think it was just something... You know, at that time, like we were learning about what was possible with making a record, and some of the records that were coming out, even in the like hardcore and punk scene at the time, would have these like little interstitial moments of acoustic stuff or field recordings or something like that. So I think we were just trying to kind of see what we could do, and Paul was a great guitar player. Is a great guitar player, and we were just trying to figure out, how to play together.
Hmm. No, it always struck me as like it was one of the most unique records of the time because no one would do that. It was in a weird way kind of daring to just have all of a sudden these like little soft moments, if you will.
I think we also just wanted to like we really, felt like an album or a record was a really important thing, and we wanted to put everything we had into it. Literally to the point where it was like 22 songs or something and like 4-track recordings.
It's behind me here somewhere, the CD.
Right. And like, the layout booklet is really deep. Yeah. Like there's a lot to it and it's, and some hilarious drawings.
There's some great drawings.
It was just, I think we wanted to put, we may have put too much on one CD, but that was just out of, wanting it to be really part of something that we thought important.
That's the way it works when you think something's important. You explode, mm-hmm. essentially, and it's all there. The artwork's really nice, too. I haven't revisited this record in a while. I might slap it in the car. I wanted to do something now, but you were like, no.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It's hard to listen to stuff that you made when you were 17.
Of course. No, of course. But it's striking. Now, at some point after Shoulder, the Constantine started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Here in Guelph.
Sort of. The Constantine started in 1999, and I was still living in London in my last year at CHRW and at school. and so I was working as the music director there, and we hadn't, Shoulder had stopped a few years earlier, but I had learned so much about music and contemporary music just as music director at this campus community radio station. So Doug and I, we had been friends. We'd been playing together since early high school, and he was at school here in Waterloo, and we just decided to try and start playing together. And we knew Dallas and Steve through Captain Copilot, which was your band with mm-hmm. them, from the Button Factory shows, I think, mostly.
Yeah, I remember you two came to one of a semi-disastrous Button Factory show we played.
Was it disastrous for you? We don't have to talk about
this. No, at the end of the Captain Copilot towards the end was strange for us as kids, and my heart wasn't really into it the way it should have been, I think, and I regret it, actually. But it was the summer, and I was working in Cambridge. These guys still were in Guelph. And I remember that Button Factory show, there was confusion. I didn't bring a drum kit. I just didn't bring it. I thought that we would – I was just like, oh, I forgot to bring the – I had to work, like a midnight shift or something. I'm like, there's no way I can – so we ended up – I just remember that I had to share the drum very kindly. There was no backline in Southern Ontario hardcore mm-hmm. punk. Right. Everyone just brought everything and took everything down, and mm-hmm. no one was really practical in some ways. You just didn't talk. You just were like, yeah, you take your thing down, I'll put my thing down. It's the exact same thing.
Right. Well, most of the gear, like most of the drum kits, were held together by duct tape.
I think there was like too. Please don't play my kit. Anyway, very kindly, the folks that we were playing with, I think that, or maybe you were at a, maybe you
was
saw
it Still Life. Who was it that you were playing with?
Maybe.
I can't remember which show it was.
You saw us a few times, right?
Yeah, for sure. But that was the thing. So this was, the Button Factory was the great kind of rental hall show space in KW.
In Waterloo, actually. It's just off of, I think the building's still there. It's like just off of Bridgeport and Herb or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I saw, probably.
Propagandi, did you see them there?
Yeah. Loads of like great shows throughout. What would that have been, like 94 to 97 or something like that?
Yeah. 99 even, maybe.
Yeah. That was how I met lots of people. And that was part of that kind of network. You know, you could play in Mississauga and Brantford and Waterloo and London and all these places in between, which was how we spent our weekends and going to see shows at these places. So anyway, Doug was at school here, and we just decided to start trying to play a bit again, and ask Dallas if he wanted to play first, and then ask Steve as well. And we just started. I actually started rehearsing above Call the Office in London for a few months.
Yeah,
in a great space up there that was, you know, they had rehearsal spaces that I spent hours and hours of my youth in, and I remember when Doug would play the drums particularly loud, pigeon feathers would fall through a hole in the ceiling over him. So we started there, and then pretty soon after, I moved to Guelph, where Dallas and Steve were living, and we lived in a house on Huron Street, mm-hmm. when I was 6 Huron Street, and started doing some shows there and rehearsing in the basement.
Okay, so it was kind of a London-Guelph amalgam.
Yeah, at the beginning, yeah.
Makes sense.
I think I was the community, like the show-going community that I talked about at the beginning of the show, felt like it had kind of dissipated a little bit at that time, and I didn't feel like a strong community connection to London towards the end of, you know, 98, 99, and at the same time, I was becoming enamored with what I perceived to be a really strong community in Guelph, an amazing, like, diverse art community here, finding out about people like Jim Guthrie, and I remember the Goods compilation was like a revelation to me. I just thought if like a city the size of Guelph can produce a compilation that divergent in styles and so full of quality songwriting and ideas, that it must be an amazing place. And we had played here, and I knew Aaron as well. Aaron
Riches,
through playing with Minnow, and
we did. We organized the last Minnow show down below
Peter Clark Hall.
Peter Clark Hall, and we divided the smaller version of it or whatever. And the show was Minnow, which was Aaron Riches, who went on to form Royal City. Mm-hmm. Chili, which was Jim Guthrie, Charles Jansen, and Alka Sharma. Jim, of course, went on to Royal City. Blake.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mm-hmm. Which is Evan Clark and Jim McIntyre and Gus Weinkoff. All of those guys went on, and Evan went on to play with Jim Guthrie. Jim McIntyre went on to form this band Sea Snakes. Mm-hmm. and you guys. Mm-hmm. So basically, like this weird. So and for I'm not very being very clear, but Three Gut Records basically
came
started
out of that.
Like it felt like that was the first. Like that's ground zero for what became the Three Gut Records community.
That's very. It's funny to hear it all. To hear the walkthrough, because it is very true, and I we may have like spoken about that a little bit here and there before,
maybe, but it was like I think I ended up organizing that show because the fellow that normally would do it was one of the first times I really learned how to put on a show because he couldn't do it. He just couldn't do it. He started the process and then he couldn't be there, and I had to pay everyone, and it was the first time. But and Dallas Worley, Dallas from the Cons, videotaped it.
Hmm.
He videotaped definitely Minnow. No, he videotaped, I think, a little bit of everyone. And there's a tape somewhere of...
I remember watching the Minnow footage with Dallas, yeah.
Pretty remarkable.
Yeah, well, and it was like, I mean, that was a big deal for us. Like, you know, Aaron certainly, for me, was like a kind of towering figure in his own, you know, way, but was in you know the hardcore and punk rock scene of the late 90s, and Guelph also just had this feeling. I remember talking with Doug about this, where Guelph just sort of felt like this DC, we drew comparisons.
Well, it has history actually with the DC scene.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I just saw that like integrity of the and intelligence behind the music and art scene here that we likened to the Discord kind of community in Washington, D.C. And so, yeah, just being asked to play that and Aaron saying, great set, after we played was really a big deal.
Yeah, no, that was a magical night, and I always think of it. When I think about early Cons and your writing, I think of your reverence for the people you admire. You often would... you mentioned SOS, taking rock riffs from people. You would often incorporate other people's lyrics, like songs you admired, would end up in your songs.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of, eventually I feel like that ended. Like it seemed like you were trying to use other voices to find your own voice. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess.
A lot of it was sloganeer. Like a lot of it was like anthemic, kind of like, this makes me feel a certain way. And
I think it was really like, through whatever, you know, at the time I was studying, you know, poetics and poetic rhetoric and stuff like that, you know, in school, and was learning a bit about the idea of recontextualizing or you know, appropriating or misappropriating things, you know, changing the...
sampling?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in a way, for sure. And so I think I was just fascinated with that idea at the time, and so would take... I mean, not. I wasn't thinking that clearly about it when SOS were stealing like "Sunshine
no,
of
no.
Your Love" riffs, but with the Cons, you know, I lifted lines from "Young Turks" by Rod Stewart and kind of things that were, you know, kind of beautiful lines, but in their original context, just seemed, I don't know, disingenuous or seemed. They just seemed like they could be used in a different context.
But there's a lore.
Way.
But it's a callback to rock lore. Like when you're screaming, "Can I get a witness?"
Right.
Like I'm just like immediately like this is and then you know people kind of it was a subtle way of getting to soul in a weird way.
Yeah.
Like it was all of the connections you made. You know, on the surface it just seemed like people paying tribute to the things they love. But I actually think. When I think back on it, you were drawing from that power.
Yeah. I think, to be fair, like, I think there was also, we were learning that trick from Nation of Ulysses and Springsteen and stuff, you know, like, and The Clash, like, all, you know, things that were shout outs to earlier things that were important to us and trying to incorporate them in what we were doing.
Yeah.
And, to speak to like why that kind of stopped gradually, I think I just started feeling guilty about appropriating some of those things, you know, and started trying to be a bit more critical about whose voice I was, you know, taking on.
But the Cons also then faced the inevitable like pigeonholing. You would do the things you did. You would pay tribute to the people you mentioned, and then people would be like, yeah, this band just sounds like The Clash and Springsteen and The Replacement. Like, they would just put that on you.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you're in a weird, like, did I do this to myself? Did I kind of give these people a map to where they can take, you know, where how they can contextualize our band?
Mm-hmm.
That must have been tricky
to
deal with.
Yeah. I mean, Springsteen meets Fugazi thing was like the most reoccurring thing, and that just kind of became comical in that it was like that was the pull quote or the thing that just was sampled from Stuart Berman, I think, originally and then used in almost every review afterwards. But it's kind of apt as well, and it's an interesting
two things you admire, like two entities you admire.
For sure. Yeah. And I think, I mean, we just kind of let that go eventually, and it became laughable, and you just let it happen. And at every stage of the game, I think I was just surprised that at the opportunities that came our way, always surprised that people were listening, you know, and that kind of thing. I anytime we played a place, you know, a remote place, and there were actually people there that were interested was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, sure, know? Sure. Eventually, the con stopped. I guess it would have been 2010?
Yep.
Okay. So the cons stop, and the reasoning is that basically you want to start a family and sort of realize that this lifestyle they don't seem to match up.
Yeah, it wasn't healthy. I didn't feel healthy at the time.
Yeah.
It was a big part of it. Like, we'd been sick a lot, or I'd been sick a lot on the road, and I spent a few years just kind of floating and, you know, not really having much of a sense of home. And
you were in Montreal mostly at that point?
Well, yeah. Like, it was kind of the transition into living in Montreal and meeting my partner, Katie. And that began kind of that paralleled, you know, just an overall interest in home and an idea of home and a more stable, sustainable, healthier lifestyle compared to what I was doing. And, you know, there's all sorts of kind of conflicts that happen just when you're working with the same five people for 10 years, you gradually, you know, priorities shift and everybody has sort of different priorities or things pull in different ways, and it just wasn't seeming sustainable or compatible at the time.
Sure.
And I think we all loved each other, you know, deeply as you know, in a brotherly way, because we had, you know, grown up playing music together and been through a lot together. So we, rather than saying, you know, I don't want to play with you ever again, or I don't want, you know, this to exist at all anymore, we just said it was a indefinite hiatus and stopped and didn't do a lot of press about it. And, you know,
well, I ended up being kind of part of this thing because basically, and I want to ask you about this because what happened was we were all in Dawson City, and I invited you guys to be on, at the time I had a show on CBC, and one of my segments was the Breakfast Club. So we had breakfast together and we did an interview, and we all got to Dawson City, and then there was this murmuring that the cons were done. It was in the program. This will be their last show.
Yeah.
And when I spoke to other members of the band, they said, nope, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's happening. But your parents were there, and your parent and Katie was there, and they were like, yeah, last one. And they were just like, what? And I was in the middle of like, what the hell is going on? Like, the communication, like, and from what I understand, so we had this radio interview, which was incredibly awkward in a lot of ways, but that's what happens when the five of six of us were, no, Will wasn't there, I don't think.
It's just what happens with the Constantines.
What is going on? Like, why was the communication? Like, you love each other, but why could you not?
Well, I mean, I think we were all kind of introverted people, or none of us were ever terribly comfortable being like outwardly, you know, you know, publicizing ourselves or promoting ourselves.
No, but this would have been an internal like conversation that didn't seem to, it seemed to be happening before me.
No, that's not exactly true.
Okay.
I think we just hadn't talked about, like, when that interview happened, we hadn't talked about how we were going to present the fact that we were going to stop playing.
Right.
So and it did kind of come out in that way. And I think I probably just took the reins in that interview and said, well, yeah, this is what's happening.
And then,
probably because it was more, to be honest, it was more, I initiated that, that end, I think, you know?
Yeah. So we're now at a stage where you are, I mean, you and I have talked about Provider before, which followed basically your first solo album followed this activity. Or, I mean, actually, you took a break. You just sort of stopped, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you didn't really play music publicly and that much. And
right. Well, the cons, that last show was in Dawson City at the festival in 2010. And then, yeah, I mean, it just took a while to figure out how to make music. I just, you know, realized pretty quickly that I didn't know how to make music outside of the Constantines particularly well. I had been trying other things, but without...
You had this band, the Harbor Coats.
Right.
And, yeah.
And it was just... I think I just needed time to figure out who I was as a musician outside of that band, you know?
So. And then the articulation, I think, of a lot of those sentiments and feelings comes through in Provider.
Mm-hmm.
That first record where you're just like, I'm an adult now. Not to cry. Basically, that's...
Where we cover the pursuit of happiness.
But it is a record about a coming of age. And also the birth of your son.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sensed after you released that record a sense of release from you. I got the impression that that was therapeutic for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I might be reading too much into it. Because since then, that record came out and you did sporadic touring. You figured out, because I think part of why you were like, I can't be a rock musician with a family. Part of what Provider showed you is that you kind of could. Mm-hmm. You could tour across the world and... In chunks and be home still and be a presence, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it came down to realizing that you could set, you know, any kind of parameter, any kind of boundaries that you want around what you're doing. Partly, admittedly, with the luxury of having a day job and a supportive family, you know, that are willing to allow me, you know, to do this stuff. But it was definitely, I felt very liberated by releasing that and realizing that it was possible and that there was an audience still for that other kind of stuff that I wanted to do. So
yeah. And so now we're at a stage where you've got this record Free Will.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, I think, expresses a kind of liberation. I mean, and it seems like almost, is it a response record to Provider in some way?
It follows, you know, some of the things that I was just being introduced to, the things that we were talking about at the top of the show about being a parent and sort of realizing the temporality. Is that
That's a thing.
A thing. you know, of each moment and that kind of thing. And so connecting with that, but then, you know, growing into that a bit more and also, you know, having more moments. You get out of the initial, you know, year of having a child and there's a certain glow, you know, in that, especially in that first year where everything just seems like magical and it certainly is, you know, watching your child is magic. But after that, I started to connect on a deeper level with all sorts of, you know, maybe more complex emotions, those like fears and worries about the kind of world that I had introduced a new person into, you know.
And I don't mean to interrupt you. Provider is such it's a gorgeous title for a record from a new dad because... I think that it evokes the responsibility. In a happy sense, it evokes the responsibility, but it also evokes a trap.
Yeah.
It evokes a closing in.
Mm-hmm.
That responsibility, it just articulated so beautifully in that title and throughout the songs on that record of you kind of grappling with what this means, what your role in this world is now. And then when I hear Free Will, like when you told me you were calling it Free Will, I kind of thought, oh, like it's kind of like, actually, there's freedom here. Mm-hmm. There's actually, it's not a trap. It's not a cage. And so maybe I'm being a music critic about it and trying to connect too many dots.
No, I mean, I know, I think you're finding things that are there for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing with free will, again, like talking about discovering the, or connecting with the, you know, whatever the preciousness of a moment, or the, you know, the value of a moment, or the, you know, the connecting with the fact that you can make any number of decisions in a moment came as a follow-up to all of the things that came with having a child and then that first year. So this, you know, now I'm working with a 3-year-old who is discovering his own agency in the world.
Free will.
Yeah. So that's the complexity in that is that, you know, you want to, as we were talking about earlier, you want to find a way to help this person survive in the world and to be a responsible and respectful human being. But I also am inclined to just celebrate every time he makes a decision that is the opposite of the decision I would have made, you know?
Interesting. Okay.
You know, it's invigorating and electrifying to see his agency in the world.
And it's a
I discover things about my own. It just reveals things about yourself that you may have taken for granted.
I think raising a kid does that.
Yeah.
Because you're reliving life, in a sense.
For sure.
Through them. Okay, so that's interesting to me. Because I also saw it as a pun. Because Will Oldham, Will Kidman, not Will Oldham, is on the record.
That was why. I mean, that was ultimate. Like as soon as what happened was Will Kidman from the Constantines was visiting Ontario for his brother's wedding, I believe, and was in town for, you know, a few days, and I had some studio time, and I asked if he'd come up and just do like a 2-guitar feedback thing in the studio for a song, and it was perfect. Like if you know Will's playing, especially Will's an incredible guitarist as well, and so it just was one of my favorite moments in the studio of making this record, and that idea like of free will was kind of floating around because the word will appears in I think every song on the record as well. But as soon as that happened that night playing with Will, it seemed like the perfect kind of tribute to this friend, you know, who I had finally reconnected with after a few years.
Yeah.
A great, just a celebration of that moment, you know.
And are you concerned about the connection to the film Free Willy?
No, I'm not concerned about that.
What if people say, you know, the Spry Web record Free Will, it's a whale of an album. What if they say that? Oh, it's killer.
I'll take it. I'll take it.
So, okay. So listening to it, I felt that there were connections between the two records, and that it's interesting to me that both are really inspired by your son.
Yeah.
More than anything.
Yep.
Yeah. This seems to be your main muse.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing with, you know, stopping making music for a little while, was trying to figure out how to start again and why to start again, why to write another song. And I wrote the song Asa, a lullaby for him, the first song on Provider. And it was the, you know, first song I had written in a long time, and just kind of made me realize that if, you know, writing a song for him was a good enough reason to write a song. You know?
Yeah.
And so that's been a big part of why I've written any of the songs I've written in the last 3 or 4 years.
And on top of this record, this evocation of a free will, the Constantines are going to play again.
Yeah.
So what? It's an interesting trajectory.
Well, I mean, that comes from that same thing of just kind of realizing that I could be gone, you know, next week or, you know, tomorrow, and I just I love those guys, and I think I've realized more and more, even since we were around, that that band meant something to people. And because, you know, now, like, for me, it just occupies a place of joy and goodness, and so I just want to reconnect with it rather than let it go. You know, life's too short, so the right opportunities just kind of jumped up in the last year, and because of the reconnection of, you know, we, Will and I playing together, and we had done our, you know, Crazy Horse cover band at the Silver Dollar and stuff in the last year. Just
Horsey Craze.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all reconnected at Sappy Fest, you know, Deloro, Dallas's band, and Baby Eagle, and everybody was out playing at Sappy Fest pretty much last year. And
except for Doug.
Yeah. But we've all connected it in these different ways, and just seemed to come together. Seem to be pointing to that.
So what's the plan?
I don't know. We just sort of made that decision around like last year. What happened was, you know, Shine a Light was our second record, and last year, last September, would have been the 10th anniversary of Shine a Light. And about the end of August, I think like Steve or may have sent out a message saying, you guys want to do something for the, maybe we should have done something for the 10th anniversary of Shine a Light. And that, you know, a classic, you know, we were never particularly good at timing. So we just kind of started this jokey, you know, chain of emails. And but gradually we started talking about doing something, reissuing that anyway, because it's been out of print for a while. And Sub Pop, who released it, in the world excluding Canada, initially they were really excited about reissuing it as well. So we're going to put it out, reissue it with Sub Pop and You've Changed in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the date is June 10th.
Oh, it's coming up that quickly.
Yeah, June 10th or June 20th. I'm sorry, I can't.
That's okay.
Recall, but it's June. It's actually coming out. I found that out like last week.
wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
People have just been really on it in terms of getting it together to put out. Steve runs You've Changed Records, and our relationship with Sub Pop is really great. Chris Jacobs, who is always our guy there, has been helping out with this. And so, yeah, it's going to come out mid-June, we'll say, anyway, and we'll have it at some shows that we're going to play this summer.
And the shows are still kind of up in the air.
Yeah. Right now, we're going to play, we can say that we're going to play Field Trip, the festival at the Garrison Commons in Toronto we're playing on the 8th of June. I feel like I'm not overstepping to say that we just confirmed that we're going to play Sappy Fest.
Amazing.
Yeah, that was I think when we started talking about shows that we wanted to do, that was one that I really wanted to happen, and everybody was excited about that. The Sappy Fest in Sackville, New Brunswick, has always been a close connection for us. So, so that's going to happen, and Steve and I are both playing solo there as well. I'm just going to keep going.
Go.
We're playing, I believe, Peterborough Folk Fest on the 22nd of August.
And the Cons?
Cons.
Okay.
And Arboretum in Ottawa on the 23rd.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then you've got your own stuff.
Yeah, and I'm playing a bunch this summer as well. And yeah, I don't know.
All right.
With the last few minutes to turn into a list of
no, that's fine. But, and we'll send people the info. By the way, I just looked up my calendar, and June 10th is a Tuesday, which would be a traditional
that
release
makes
date.
Sense, yeah.
So it looks like Channel Lights probably the 20th is a Friday.
Right.
I imagine it's the 10th or the 17th,
I believe.
Probably.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
I'm going to go out and play with Rich Burnett and Nathan Lohr, who I play with in my own solo kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. We're going to play with Chad Van Galen and Cousins on a tour of the Northeast and from Boston to Chicago in May, and then a bunch of other shows in Canada and a bunch of festivals and stuff this summer.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Bri, it was great to have you on the show. unfortunately, we have to wind things up here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I hope it was helpful.
It was helpful.
It's helpful to chat sometimes. Yeah. Now, can we play a song from Free Will, which is out May 20th, but is there something we can share with people now that they may not have heard, or is there something that works with what we've been discussing?
Yeah. Do you want to play...
I want to play whatever you want.
Yeah. do you want to play Positive People?
Yeah, I do.
Positive People, I just want to preface by saying, like, I wrote it a long time ago before becoming a parent. It is meant to be a bit of a satire of you know, any kind of heteronormative nonsense. Now being on kind of the other side of you know, having a family, and it just seemed like a bit it was pretty rich with some irony.
Yeah,
to,
and
to
I remember you.
Record.
I remember you playing this at Sappy Fest and other places, and yeah. It's a cool song. So, before we go, where can people learn more about Bri Webb?
BriWebb.com.
BriWebb.com, and go see Bri opening up for Destroyer on April 11th, if you hear this in time.
Yeah, and the label is Idefix, which is IDEEFIXE, and you can order the record there.
Yeah, you can order the record there, and kazookazoo.ca for info about that Destroyer show. Mm-hmm. Bri, we're out of time. Never happened on this show before, but we're on the clock here. So here it is, Positive People from the new album Free Will by Bri Webb. Bri, thank you.
Thank you.
Postures of Defeat. Are these postures of defeat? Red with laughter, half asleep. Are these postures of defeat? Brave onward. Madam Miranda, you face a council of despair. Wired as an Irish harp, animals inside your heart. Flowers in your hair. And kisses, Mr. and Mrs. Positive People are making wishes. Postures of defeat. Are these postures of defeat? Beam counters and moonshiners, pirates of the quill, industries of innuendo. Innuendo pending. The want is the will. Positive people are ready and willing. Positive people. Positive people are ready and willing. Positive people are having children. Strength through boredom. Strength. drink through joy. You can't ignore them. You can't avoid positive people. Postures of defeat. Are these postures of defeat? Are these postures of defeat? Stay shy, dress cheap.
Hey, thanks again for checking out Creative Control with Vish Khanna. You can email me about the show at creativecontrol933@gmail.com. That's creative with a K, control with a K, 933@gmail.com. You can also follow our Twitter at Vish Creative, VishKreative. And you can also like our Facebook page. A version of this show airs on CFRU in Guelph every Wednesday at noon Eastern. And you can listen to that online at cfru.ca, or if you're in the KW region at 93.3 FM in Guelph. You can also sign up for the weekly mailing list for the podcast and the show at vishkhanna.com, and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. I believe that is everything I wanted to tell you. Thank you once again.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.